From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I am still the elected and the only elected president of the country.
As ousted Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide holds a rare news conference in South Africa, law students in California file a complaint on behalf of imprisoned former Haitian Prime Minister Yvonne Neptune. We'll speak with one of the students, as well as Congressmember Maxine Waters. Then we pay tribute to humanitarian aid worker and activist Marla Rizika. She was killed in a car bomb last week in Iraq.
Marla was someone who made it possible for the Congress to... Without Marla, we never could have done what we did to get aid to people in Iraq who had been injured as a result of U.S. military mistakes.
And we take a look at the proliferation of militias in Iraq.
The U.S. revived Saddam Hussein's old security services to fight the insurgency. Donald Rumsfeld warns the Iraqi government not to purge them. Welcome to the new Iraq.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, a civilian helicopter has crashed, killing 9 people on board. The helicopter went down north of Baghdad earlier today. On Wednesday, the country was shaken by the discovery of dozens of corpses in 2 separate sites. More than 50 bodies were pulled out of the Tigris River. Iraq's new president, Jalal Talabani, suggested the bodies may have been the victims of a mass kidnapping that was reported south of Baghdad over the weekend. Talabani's comment came just days after other Iraqi officials said the kidnapping report was a hoax. Meanwhile, 19 Iraqis were found shot dead in the town of Haditha, north of Baghdad. The men appear to have been lined up against a wall and shot. There are conflicting reports as to whether the dead Iraqis were members of the Iraqi National Guard or civilians. Also on Wednesday, Iraq's outgoing Prime Minister, Iyad Alawi, escaped an assassination attempt. A suicide car bomber attacked his convoy near his home. Several guards and officers were reportedly killed in the blast. And it's been one of the deadliest weeks of the war for journalists in Iraq. The International Federation of Journalists is reporting that 5 Iraqi journalists have been killed over the past week. 2 television journalists working with Al Hurra, a TV station, died last Thursday in a suicide bombing. On the next day, 2 TV journalists from Kirkuk TV and Kurdistan Satellite Television were killed. In addition, a journalist working with the paper Al Sabah was beheaded in Baghdad. According to the International Federation of Journalists, some 75 reporters and media staff have been killed since the U.S. invasion in March 2003. The group has called on the new Iraqi government to make protection of media staff a top priority. On Capitol Hill, Republican Senator Lincoln Chafee has announced Republicans on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee will soon meet to decide whether they should recommend President Bush withdraw John Bolton's nomination to become ambassador to the United Nations. Bolton's nomination was dealt a major setback Tuesday when the Republican-led committee postponed a vote in order to allow 3 more weeks of investigations into allegations that Bolton regularly abused his power. On Wednesday, the White House defended Bolton and accused Democrats of manufacturing trumped-up allegations to discredit Bolton. The Associated Press is reporting that committee Democrats now want to interview former Deputy CIA Director John McLaughlin and 2 other high-ranking intelligence officials about possible efforts by Bolton to transfer a Latin America intelligence analyst who had disagreed with him. Meanwhile, the Washington Post has reported that Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has ordered her senior staff not to release any information that could hurt Bolton's nomination. The State Department denies such an order was given. President Bush's signature Education Reform Act, the No Child Left Behind bill, is being challenged in court. On Wednesday, the nation's largest teachers union, National Education Association, and school districts in Texas, Michigan, and Vermont filed a lawsuit that charges the federal government is illegally forcing schools to comply with parts of the act not paid for by the government. In addition, the lawsuit argues the federal government has shortchanged schools at least $27 billion. Meanwhile, the Republican-led legislature in Utah voted Tuesday to make state education standards a priority over federal ones imposed by the No Child Left Behind Act. In Ecuador, weeks of mass street protests have forced out the country's president, Lucio Gutierrez. On Wednesday, the Ecuadorian Congress removed Gutierrez from office and named his vice president, Alfredo Palacio, to head of state. Gutierrez attempted to flee the country by helicopter, but protesters took over the airport, preventing his private jet from departing. Instead, Gutierrez took refuge in Brazil's embassy in Quito and was granted asylum. Gutierrez was elected in 2003 on a largely leftist platform, but he's been widely accused of abandoning his campaign promises. Instead of instituting social and economic reforms, he ended up supporting austerity policies drawn up by the International Monetary Fund. In Mexico, prosecutors have filed charges against populist leader Andrés Manuel López Obrador in a move that could bar him from running in next year's presidential election. López Obrador is the mayor of Mexico City and had appeared poised to win next year's election, running on a platform in part against the policies of sitting President Vicente Fox. Under the Mexican Constitution, Fox cannot seek re-election. While charges were filed, no arrest warrant was issued. Prosecutors allege the mayor ignored a court order several years ago in an obscure land case involving the building of a hospital road. Under Mexican law, López Obrador would likely be barred from running if he is still facing criminal charges at the time of the election. Back in this country, the House of Representatives has passed a $8 billion energy bill. The legislation will do little to rein in rising gas prices, but it's expected to save oil companies billions of dollars by shielding them from costly lawsuits. The legislation has a provision that would immediately protect oil companies from lawsuits over the water-polluting gasoline additive MTBE. Major MTBE producers include ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips. California alone has more than 15,000 sites contaminated with MTBE. One of the main backers of the liability waiver is House Majority Leader Tom DeLay of Texas. The energy bill will also allow oil drilling in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The San Francisco Chronicle reports the bill is being widely opposed by top state there, including top members of the Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's cabinet. They're worried the bill will make it tougher for the state to block offshore oil drilling or the placement of liquefied natural gas terminals. Meanwhile, President Bush has signed the largest overhaul of the nation's bankruptcy laws in over a quarter of a century. Legislation has been sought for years by the credit card and banking industries because it'll make it harder for individuals to wipe out their debts. Also in Washington, independent Vermont Senator Jim Jeffords has announced he will not seek re-election next year. Jeffords defected from the Republican Party in 2001. During a news conference, the 71-year-old senator cited unspecified health concerns as well as the health of his wife, who's undergoing chemotherapy for cancer. Speculation has already begun that Congressmember Bernie Sanders, also an independent, will seek Jeffords' seat. Sanders has been Vermont's lone congressmember since 1991. Vermont's Governor Jim Douglas is seen as a likely Republican candidate. In an update on a story we've been tracking, the case of federal whistleblower Sybil Edmonds took a surprise turn Wednesday. Edmonds, the former FBI translator who was fired after complaining about security breaches within the agency, she's now suing the FBI over her dismissal. On Wednesday, the U.S. Court of Appeals ordered that today's oral arguments in the case be conducted in secret, with the media and public barred from the courtroom. The court gave no reason why it made the extraordinary decision. The American Civil Liberties Union and a dozen news organizations have sued to have the proceedings open to the public. Arthur Spitzer of the ACLU described the court's decision as, quote, unprecedented and outrageous. The American-Israel Public Affairs Committee has reportedly fired two employees at the center of an FBI spy investigation. The men, Steve Rosen and Keith Weissman, have been accused of passing on classified information to Israel regarding U.S. policy toward Iran. Until now, AIPAC has strongly defended the two men. Last year, the FBI twice raided the AIPAC offices as part of the investigation. And a series of student protests are being staged on college campuses across the country this week. At the University of California, Santa Cruz, activists have set up a tent city to protest fee hikes, shrinking financial aid, and crowded classrooms and low pay for campus workers. Earlier in the week, students accused police dressed in riot gear of brutally breaking up a protest at Tent City. 19 people were arrested. Meanwhile, at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, graduate student employees have announced they're walking out of classes today to demand a fair contract. And graduate student employees at Columbia and Yale have entered the fourth day of a week-long strike in an effort to unionize the two Ivy League graduate groups. On Wednesday, AFL-CIO President John Sweeney led a protest of hundreds at the Columbia campus in support of the striking graduate students. The job action is believed to be the first coordinated strike in the history of the Ivy League. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and the world.
Well, this is Democracy Now! As we take on the issue today of a young woman, American, who has died in Iraq. Memorial services are planned for this weekend to remember the life of 28-year-old humanitarian aid worker and activist Marla Ruzicka. She was killed in Iraq last week by a car bomb on one of Baghdad's most notorious roads. Her longtime Iraqi partner, Faiz Ali Salim, also died in the blast. Marla Ruzicka is the founder of a group called Campaign for Innocent Victims in Conflict, or CIVIC. Since the launch of the so-called War on Terror, Marla spent most of her time in Iraq and Afghanistan documenting and recording the casualties of war. The day after the fall of Baghdad, she began a door-to-door investigation of civilian casualties in Iraq and formed survey teams to fan out across the country and gather firsthand accounts from Iraqis. She continued going into Iraq even after most international aid organizations and relief agencies had pulled out. Marla took her first report to Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, who in turn sponsored unprecedented legislation to provide millions of dollars to Iraqi civilians wounded by U.S. forces in Iraq and Afghanistan.
The road Marla and Faiz were killed on is the same one that Iraqis must use to travel to speak with U.S. forces and to apply for compensation. In her online journal, Marla wrote last year, quote, "The ride is not pleasant. Military convoys passing every moment. Faiz and I hold our breath. Such convoys in that area are the targets of rockets and fire from the resistance. It would be nice if there was a more secure location for Iraqis to seek compensation." Marla was fond of saying that numbers do count. Despite the Pentagon's claim it does not keep records of civilians killed by U.S. forces, As Tommy Franks, the former head of the U.S. Central Command, famously said, quote, "We don't do body counts." The week before she died, Marla may have been on the verge of proving that statement false.
Marla had reportedly obtained information from the U.S. military about the number of civilians killed or injured during the violence after Bush declared the end of major combat operations. She was trying to get the U.S. government to publicly release these statistics about all areas of Iraq. A memorial service will be held for Marla on Saturday in her hometown of Lakeport, California. This week, she was remembered on the floor of the Senate by, among others, Senator Leahy. We're joined now by Leahy's longtime aide, Tim Reeser, in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Tim.
Thank you. It's good. Welcome.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about Marla Ruzicka and her effect on the legislation?
Marla came to us 3 years ago. She walked into my office. She'd been in Afghanistan, and I really didn't know what to think of Marla. She had been, right after the fall of the Taliban, in the middle of bombs exploding all around her, visiting families of Afghans who had lost members of their families as a result of bombs that landed in the wrong place or which were injured or killed from U.S. military mistakes. And she came to us and said, we should do something about this. We hear about these cases, but nobody ever does anything to help these people. And Senator Leahy, who had often expressed concerns about civilian victims of war and had in fact created a program years ago to help civilians in war, was the obvious person for her to come to. And really that was the beginning of a relationship that lasted right to the last day of her death. I talked with Marla either by phone or through email every day for 3 years. And what she did for us was make it possible to hear about what was happening and to learn the facts of individual cases and give Senator Leahy what he needed to be able to then establish, in the case of Afghanistan, a program to help civilians who had either lost loved ones or had their homes destroyed or otherwise suffered losses, now up to about $10 million for programs for Afghan civilian casualties. And then again in Iraq, where Marla went just the day or two after Saddam's statue fell, and for the next 2 years really risked her life every day that she was there, visiting people, showing that Americans did care about what had happened to them, and again, giving us the information that we needed to be able to establish a program to assist those people. Really the first time that I'm aware of ever that the United States government has, in a formal way, provided assistance, whether in the form of medical care or rehabilitation for someone who lost an arm or a leg, or for a woman who lost her husband, a loan to start a business, or repairing a home that was destroyed by a bomb that missed its target. Nothing like this had ever been done before, and we could not possibly have done it had it not been for Marla out there risking her life and getting the information to us.
How unusual is it for an individual citizen to come to a United States Senator's office and appeal to get involved in a foreign conflict like this and have such an enormous impact?
Never. I don't know if it's ever happened before. Marla was unique. She gave more of herself to more people than anyone I ever expect to meet, and took more risks just to help people than anyone I expect to meet. But she also learned that just protesting or being an activist in a political sense was not enough, that really if she wanted to do something for these people, she had to find ways to work with people who could help her, and that meant the Congress, it meant the U.S. military, it meant anyone who in some way, journalists who could publicize what was happening. She was interested in one thing, and that was helping people who had been hurt. And I don't know of anyone in my 20 years in the Congress working for Senator Leahy who has ever done anything like that.
We're
and
also,
done it so effectively as Marla.
We're also joined on the phone, in addition to Tim Reeser, the aide of Senator Leahy, Raed Jarar, who is an Iraqi blogger, one of the most well-known, and architect. His blog, Raed in the Middle, is at raedinthemiddle.blogspot.com. He works as director of the Iraq Survey with Marla Rizika to collect personal information on thousands of wounded Iraqi civilians. Joining us on the phone from Amman. Your thoughts today on Marla Rizika. Welcome to Democracy Now! Raed.
Thank you, Amy. I felt really sad with all of my friends here in Jordan and my Iraqi friends and all of the people that knew Marla from the time of Iraq when we heard about her death. But none of us was really surprised because of the very bad situation inside Iraq at the moment.
We're going to go to break and then come back as we talk about Marla Rizika. Remember her, young activist in Iraq, working to count the number of Iraqi dead and help Iraqi civilians. We're talking to Tim Reeser, who is a top aide to Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy. We're also on the line with Raed Jarar, Iraqi blogger and architect who worked with Marla. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll continue this conversation, and then we'll also talk about what's happening in Haiti. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're talking about Marla Rizika, who died in Iraq in a suicide car bombing. She died along with her Iraqi partner, who she had worked with for a long time, Faiz Ali Salim, who also died in the blast. Tim Reeser is our guest, a top aide to Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy. Raed Jarar on the line with us from Amman, a top Iraqi blogger. And we also are joined by Kathleen Aguilera, who is the head of Civic in this country. That's Campaign for Innocent Victims in Conflict, which was founded by Marla.
Well, I'd like to ask Raed Jarar, in the times that you discussed and worked with Marla on the developing the count of civilian casualties, did you talk with her, I'm sure you must have, about the dangers of her continuing to go back into Iraq, and what did she feel? How did she regard those dangers?
Can you please repeat the question? I didn't hear it very clearly.
Did you discuss over time with Marla, especially with all the increases in kidnappings of Westerners and attacks on Westerners, the dangers of her continually going back into Iraq to work on the civilian support?
Yeah, sure. In fact, when I met Marla the first time, it was maybe a week after the fall of Baghdad. And at that time, the situation was way much better than now. The security situation was better. But even at that time, the NGOs that were going to Iraq used to have very complicated security concerns. They didn't move except in armored cars, and like, you know, they had safety limits. From that time, I used to travel with Marla around the country. We went all over Iraq. We went all over the south of Iraq, all over the north, with like a very small taxi car, a regular car, that she didn't even like think about her security. She never like thought of wearing black jackets. She just wore like an Iraqi abba so that she would be like, you know, culturally more sensitive to people there. So, I mean, she is like more aware than most of the NGO people in Iraq about how deep is the danger of security problems in Iraq, because she went and saw all of these places by herself. But she insisted of having herself being exposed more to Iraqis, having more direct relationship with Iraqi people, because this was one of the messages that she wanted to let Iraqis received, that not all Americans are coming here with guns. Some of them are coming here to make friends and to try to fix what did this war do.
Kathleen Aguilera, can you tell us about reaction here and what this means to you, the death of Marla Ruzinka?
Sure. You know, when I met Marla, like most people, I was really impressed with the accomplishments of a woman so young, having set up the surveys in Afghanistan and Iraq and lobbied in D.C. quite successfully. But, you know, her real passion was in the individual case studies and the one-on-one with the people, going there to hold them in her arms and to help children in hospitals and women who had lost their homes and their entire families while they were out at market if the home was bombed, things like this. And she followed up with them, and people remembered her, and she was a shining light, and she was unstoppable. There was nobody that could stop her from going into danger and letting these people know that we as Americans cared. And the sessions were like therapy, because oftentimes people said to her that they know that we suffered loss in the World Trade Center, and they understand what that's like, and they know that it's not us, just like that wasn't them. And she basically represented the rest of us who care over here and want to help, but are either too busy or too scared or for whatever reason are unable to go to Iraq and hold the people ourselves. And it's that sharing that's very important and will be missed. And, you know, Marla was not just a saint, but she was a full person. She worked hard constantly, and she also played hard. And when she was home, she rollerbladed to meetings in D.C., and she danced at fundraisers. And that's how she'll be remembered here and abroad. It's just, you know, the life of the party and a humanitarian hero.
Did you discuss much with her what initially got her involved in these efforts and what motivated her to want to dedicate her life this way?
She did. She's always been this way. She said she felt it in her since she was a little girl. Her mother told me that she was already getting in trouble as early as high school for protesting student rights on campus, and began doing work with Global Exchange at an early age and wanting to know how she could go abroad and help. And when we brainstormed Civic early on, she wanted to take it worldwide. It was not going to stop in Iraq. She wanted to go wherever there is conflict and civilian casualties that were a result, and go to show that we care and try to get money to help.
Kathleen Aguilera, I want to thank you for being with us, a good friend of Marla Ruzinka, as well as campaign director of her NGO Civic, the Campaign for Innocent Victims in Conflict. Rai Jarar, thank you for being with us from Amman, Jordan. Final comment from Tim Reeser, who worked with Marla Ruzinka to help set up a special fund in the foreign aid bill to help compensate civilian victims of the U.S. invasion. Tim Reeser.
I think that the reason that those of us who knew Marla so well feel her loss so deeply, and why we will miss her so much, is that as was said, that she was doing something that we all recognized was really important and needed to be done, but she was the one who was risking her life to do it. And so, in a sense, she was not just helping the victims of those wars, but she was also helping us. And I think that we now have a responsibility to try to continue what she started. And we now see that there really is a need to do a better job of keeping track of civilian casualties so that we can do a better job of helping people who, as a result of our own mistakes, have suffered, innocent people. And that is what I think Senator Leahy wants to do in the future. That's what we as a country have to do, and it's because of Marla's work that I think we now see the importance of it.
Tim Reeser, since we have you in the studio on a different issue, we wanted to ask, as you're an aide to Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy, your response to this latest news that his colleague in the Senate, longtime Vermont Senator Jim Jeffords, is stepping down, will not be running again. Your thoughts on this now, the discussion of Bernie Sanders possibly running, possibly the governor, Republican, Douglas, and who knows what will happen with Dr. Dean, head of the DNC right now from Vermont.
Well, I can't predict what's going to happen next, but I think that we're all going to miss Senator Jeffords. He was really a Vermonter in every sense, and he represented that streak of independence that Vermonters are known for, and he did it in a way that just defied political labels. Vermonters of all types thought the world of him, and he is someone who represented the state, I think, in the best of the traditions of Vermont, and he's going to be missed. He really is, and I hope that whoever succeeds him can do so as well as he did for all Vermonters.
Tim Reeser, I want to thank you very much for being with us, top aide to Senator Patrick Leahy on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Also, on May 3rd, there's going to be a national vigil for Marla Ruzicka, as well as Faiz and victims of war in Iraq and Afghanistan. You can get more information at the website civicworldwide.org. You can go to our website, democracynow.org, and we will link to it. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we broadcast in over 330 stations around the country, on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates, on NPR stations, public access TV stations, and PBS stations. We're also broadcasting on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we video and audio stream at democracynow.org. We're closed captioned for people who are deaf or hard of hearing, and you can pick us up on any radio, TV station just by going onto our website and finding out how. 2 to 3 new stations a week are joining us this daily grassroots global unembedded news hour. As we turn now to our next subject, Juan.
Yes, well, ousted Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide held a rare press conference Tuesday in South Africa, where he is living in exile. He maintained that he is still the elected president of Haiti, despite being ousted 13 months ago in what he calls a modern-day kidnapping in the service of a coup d'etat backed by the United States. During the press conference, Aristide addressed the continued violence and repression in Haiti.
Today, in 2005, who can expect free, fair, and democratic elections in Haiti with thousands of Lavalas in jail, exile, and hiding? To repair the tragic mistake of the February 2004 kidnapping and coup d'etat, and reverse the disastrous events that it unleashed, the following steps must be taken. One, thousands of Lavalas who are in jail and in exile must be free to return home. Two, the repression that has already killed over 10,000 people must end immediately. 3. Then there must be national dialogue. 4. Free, fair, and democratic elections must be organized in an environment where the huge majority of Haitian people is neither excluded nor repressed as they have been up until today. The continued peaceful demonstrations calling for my return and the restoration of constitutional order must be heard. Racism should not maintain a black holocaust in Haiti, where African descendants proclaimed their independence 200 years ago. What an historic paradigm for all nations.
Ousted Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide is speaking in a rare news conference Tuesday in South Africa, where he's in exile. Meanwhile, law students at the University of California, Hastings, along with Haitian and U.S. attorneys, have filed a petition with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights on behalf of Haiti's former Prime Minister, Yvan Neptune. Neptune was jailed in June 2004 and is yet to see a judge in his case. We're now joined by one of the students who filed that petition, Kate Orlovsky. She is the student director of the Hastings Human Rights Project for Haiti. And in our Washington, D.C. studio, we are joined by Democratic Congressmember Maxine Waters of California. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now! We want to begin.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Congressmember Waters, what is the significance of this news conference that President Aristide has held?
First of all, I'm so pleased to have had President Aristide hold this press conference. It shows that he's still focused on his homeland, that he believes in free and fair elections. He's calling for the return of those Haitians in exile. He's basically laying out the kind of environment that must exist in order for to have democracy in Haiti.
Well, Congressmember, I'd like to ask you, in terms of the Bush administration had before the coup against President Aristide has said that Haiti was in virtual chaos, yet we've seen actually since the coup increases in killings and political murders and jailings. What's your reaction to the aftermath now over the last year?
Well, first of all, this administration does not care about Haiti. That coup d'etat was plotted and planned with Noriega from this administration and Andy Appade, who heads a group of 184, and people who have interest, monetary interest in Haiti, that want to protect cheap labor, the ability to run those factories, again, for little or no money paid to the Haitians there to ship those goods here and across Europe for profits. And so this administration not only has not cared, it has been proven that President Aristide, despite the fact he did not get the assistance from the international community that was promised, was doing a pretty darn good job of holding that country together. Since he's been gone, it has been nothing but chaos and mayhem and murder, the killing of Lavalas members. It is absolutely chaotic in Haiti since they drove him out of office.
Hmm. We're also joined on the phone by Kate Orlovsky of the Hastings Human Rights Project for Haiti at the University of California, Hastings. Can you talk about what you have filed with the international body, Commission on Human Rights?
Sure. What we have filed is a commission on behalf of Mr. Neptune that charges the interim government of Haiti with violations of the Haitian Constitution and the American Convention on Human Rights, and specifically the violation of his right to humane treatment, his right to personal liberty, and his right to a fair trial. And because only states can bring cases before the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, this petition asks the commission to bring the case on behalf of Mr. Neptune, and it also makes an urgent request for provisional measures based on grave threats to his life.
Congressmember Waters, you visited Ivan Neptune in the National Penitentiary just a few weeks ago, the former prime minister of Haiti. Can you talk about his condition?
Yes, I was very, very concerned after visiting with him. He was weak. He spoke barely above a whisper. He was very thin, and I thought he was sinking into depression. I was afraid that should he remain in that penitentiary, he would certainly die. And I think that's what this interim government wanted to happen. And I was very pleased that I was able to bring attention to his condition, and he was moved to the hospital where now he has a chance of living. I'm just delighted about this lawsuit that is being filed by these students. I think this is very much needed, and it may go a long way toward not only continuing to help save his life, but perhaps freeing him. But of course, if he is freed, his life will be in danger. This government must take responsibility for helping to normalize Haiti, to helping to get rid of the violence in Haiti. The UN must take responsibility, the United States, Canada, and France, all who supported the coup d'etat, must take responsibility to normalize Haiti, to get rid of this violence, and to open the way to fair and free elections.
Congressmember Waters, we'd like to ask you to stay with us. We have to go to break for 60
yes.
seconds. Congressmember Waters, in the studio in Washington, recently visited the former prime minister of Haiti, Ivan Neptune, in prison in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're talking about the latest situation in Haiti with Congressmember Maxine Waters of California, who has championed this issue for over the last year since the Aristides were ousted from power on February 29, 2004. President Aristides saying from the place that he was flown off to the Central African Republic by with the U.S. military and security, saying he was the victim of a modern kidnapping in the service of a coup d'etat backed by the United States. We're also joined on the line by Kate Orlovsky of the Hastings Human Rights Project for Haiti, a student who's filed a petition on behalf of the ousted Prime Minister Ivan Neptune, who's in prison in Haiti right now, has been there since June 2004. Congressmember Waters, has Ivan Neptune ever seen a judge?
No. As a matter of fact, he's not been formally charged. These trumped-up charges by the Minister of Justice and La Tour, the puppet leader of Haiti, are just that. They're trumped-up charges with no basis for him being jailed, no facts. They simply accuse him of having been in a location where following his having been there after he left, supposedly some killings took place. Even that, whether or not people were killed, is in question. So, no, he's not been able to have an attorney, nor has he been formally charged. It's just an absolute outrage.
What about the role of the United Nations in Haiti, the peacekeepers that are in there, and the possibility for any kind of elections that would be fair and democratic occurring in the country under these conditions?
Well, I think the UN troops are just now beginning to exercise some authority. I think that the mission was unclear, that they did not have clear direction. For most of the time that they've been there, they've had a hands-off policy mostly on the violence that was going on. Recently, they've started to exercise more authority, and I'm very pleased that they helped to provide some security for me when I went there, along with the ambassador who helped to provide security for me to get to the penitentiary. But we've got to be clear about what their charge is and what their mission is. They've got to be directed by the UN. But certainly, this country is not ready for any elections at this point and will not be for a long time to come. So I am not at all enthusiastic about the so-called planning that is going on. Planning in the absence of a clear-cut a plan to make sure that the violence is gotten rid of just doesn't make any sense to me.
And I wanted to go back for a minute to our guest on the telephone from University of California, Hastings. Why you got involved with this? Why this group of students from UC Hastings are involved?
Well, the reason that we got involved, first of all, there are a number of students who wanted to gain practical experience in international human rights. And second, we have, as a school, a relationship with Haiti. There are a number of us who have just returned from Haiti. We went there in March on a totally different matter, but to participate in an academic conference with a law school there. And Hastings has had this relationship with this law school in Haiti for about 5 years now. And so there is a personal connection there with the students and with the professors, and a lot of us feel very strongly about the country and about what happens there. And then the third thing that really made this possible was the support of Brian Concannon and the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. And Brian is a human rights attorney who I think you're probably familiar with. And the Institute for Justice and Democracy is doing some of the best work, along with the Bureau des Avocats Internationaux in Port-au-Prince, on behalf of political prisoners in Haiti. So Brian was willing to work with us, and he has been, we absolutely could not have done this without him and without the support of our professors. So they've all made it possible for us.
Last question for Congressmember Waters. What are you doing about this in Congress? Is the Congressional Black Caucus involved at all?
Well, we always have been involved at every point of trying to make sure that we disseminate information about what is going on. The most difficult problem has been we don't get good press reports out of Haiti. And so trying to keep the members of Congress informed, the American public informed, has been a very difficult challenge and a very difficult chore. I continue to stay in touch with the ambassador there. I write letters to the State Department now, to Condoleezza Rice. I kind of stay on the case, and I keep them reminded at all times that I'm watching, I'm working, I'm looking. I stay connected with CARICOM. I stay connected with President Aristide and people like Brian Concannon. And we hold meetings from time to time here in Congress, and we try to make sure that the truth is told. So we continue to work in every way that we possibly can to try and bring real democracy to Haiti.
Congressman.
And to try and get, yes.
Oh, I just wanted to thank you very much for being with us, Congressmember Maxine Waters, speaking to us from Washington, D.C., and Kate Orlovsky of the Hastings Human Rights Project for Haiti in California. We wanted to turn for a moment, Juan, to a piece you did in the New York Daily News, to a local issue that involves Haitian students in New York. Can you tell us what happened just a few weeks ago?
Yes. Well, I reported last week that about a month ago at a public school in Queens, New York, there was an incident that has really outraged the very large Haitian community here in New York. In a public school, you know, a normal fight broke out between a couple of Haitian students who were in a bilingual class. And there was an incredible reaction by a local assistant principal there who basically tried to punish all 13 Haitian children in this class by having them sit on the floor of the school cafeteria during lunchtime in front of all the other students, eat their chicken and rice lunch with their fingers, not allowing them to have any utensils, and then told them, they treat you like animals in Haiti, and that's how I'm going to treat you here, according to several of the students who were basically stunned, and several broke out crying, asking to just to be able to get utensils to eat their food. And the parents then went to the principal, who attempted, apparently, according to them, to cover the whole incident up. And it's created quite a furor now, as parents throughout Queens and Haitian and the Haitian leaders throughout the city are demanding that the school's chancellor fire both the principal, who tried to cover up the situation, and the assistant principal, who actually instituted this bizarre punishment of these children. And it's touched a nerve in the Haitian community, because so many have felt over the years that their children are not being properly dealt with in the public schools. So it remains to be seen exactly how the chancellor will deal with the situation.
Well, today there is another protest that is going to be held in front of PS 34 from 2 to 4 o'clock, and we'll let people know what happens as a result of this story. Well, finally, we're joined in the studio by Arun Gupta, who has been reporting on the proliferation of militias in Iraq. Arun is an editor with the New York City Independent Media Center's newspaper, The Independent. He writes in his article that the U.S. government is not only aware of these illegal militias, but is arming, training, and funding them for use in their counterinsurgency operations. His article will be in the May issue of Z Magazine, and we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
To talk about what's happened.
Well, these militias, which the government, U.S. government is referring to as pop-up militias, first came to prominence a couple of months ago in a report in the Wall Street Journal. This journal reporter, Greg Jaffe, noted that these militias are appearing all over Iraq, and he was interviewing various members of General Petraeus' staff. General Petraeus is the U.S. general and head of training all security services in Iraq. And it was presented as like, gee, all these militias are starting to appear all over Baghdad. Militias with names like the Mathana Brigade, the Defenders of Qadamiya, and the Special Police Commandos. And Petraeus' staff was interested in funding and supporting these. But what it really appears to be turning out that these have been set up in secret with the U.S. government's knowledge all along. And that in many instances, these militias are actually ex-Baathists. Many of the thugs who served under Saddam Hussein in his notorious intelligence services, and they are being deployed extensively throughout Iraq in counterinsurgency operations. They've also been implicated in death squad operations known as the Salvador operation, the Salvador option, and they also appear to be using torture extensively throughout Iraq. So it's a very unseemly situation. What essentially the U.S. is trying to do is privatize, is outsource these militias and provide itself with cover, but the whole time it's actually funding and creating these militias, apparently.
Now, your article seems to indicate also that the militias have been having some effect on the resistance, in that the actual, just by counting the toll of American soldiers, that there's been a reduction in recent months of the actual number of American soldiers killed. Could you talk about that?
Yes. The peak number of U.S. soldiers killed in combat was last November during the sacking of Fallujah. 126 U.S. soldiers died in combat. By this past March, it had fallen by 75%. So going on that and U.S. casualties in general, it appears that there is some success. They're using these militias extensively in the so-called Sunni Triangle area, Baghdad, Mosul, Samarra, Tikrit, Ramadi. And what it appears to be, according to Jane's Intelligence Digest, is that they're using ex-Baathists to hunt down their former colleagues who are directing much of the insurgency. So the U.S. is saying, like, well, these are a bunch of Baathist dead-enders in the insurgency, but at the same time, they're using the ex-Baathists themselves, who they said they were freeing Iraq from, to hunt down insurgents. But they're also just rounding people up willy-nilly. And there appears, like I said, to be extensive use of torture, much of it coming from this TV show that is now appearing on Iraq called Terror in the Grip of Justice. There have been many accounts of this in the media where a number of times a week on this television station set up by the Pentagon, Al-Iraqiya, they parade insurgents before the TV, and these reports are all noting that the suspects have swollen faces, bruised, that they're very cowed. And they're also admitting to the most absurd charges, that they are participating in gay orgies, that they get drunk inside mosques, that they're pedophiles engaging in rape, that they practice beheadings by cutting off the head of sheep. And the interesting thing is, one commentator noted, it's the exact same tactic Saddam Hussein used under his government of airing televised confessions. And there's one Baathist in particular who is at very much the center of this. It's General Adnan Thabit, who was involved in the 1996 coup against Saddam Hussein that the former interim prime minister, who just resigned, Iyad Alawi, headed up. And this character, Thabit, keeps popping up all over the place. He's the head of the special police commandos, which are said to number 10 to 11,000, which would actually make them the second largest security force in Iraq, larger than the British. He was also the source for this raid a few weeks ago on this insurgent camp on Lake Tharthar that turned out to be bogus, pretty much. A reporter went there and found that there were all these insurgents still there, even though Thabit was saying something like 85 insurgents were killed. He's also now involved in this dispute over what's going on in this town south of Baghdad, claiming there wasn't any kidnapping, and now there's reports of all these bodies being dragged out of the river. And the Interior Ministry a couple days ago even said he was assassinated and then retracted the report the same day. He's a very shady character, and the U.S. General Staff under Petraeus notes that he's very powerful and that if he is removed, he could take his militias with him, this huge force. And right now there's a power struggle going on. Donald Rumsfeld flew into Baghdad last week and warned the new government not to purge these Baathists. This largely escaped the notice of many in the media. And Talabani, who is the new president, said that, no, we are going to purge them and we want to use our militias.
Arun Gupta, we want to thank you very much for being with us. If people want to read this article, where can they go on the web?
They can go to Z Magazine. They can also go to the New York City Indie Media Center, nyc.indiemedia.org, where it'll be appearing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Piece is called Let a Thousand Militias Bloom, and that does it for today's program. Tonight, the Unembed the Media Tour continues in Los Angeles, an evening with Tariq Ali, Emmanuel Presbyterian Church with KPFK, and tomorrow we'll be in Claremont, California, California at the Humanities Auditorium Scripps Campus, and then Glendale at Glendale Community College in the afternoon, and the evening, Berkeley, California, celebrating Berkeley Community Media at Florence Schwimley Little Theater. On Saturday, San Francisco New Life Expo, and at night in Ashland, Oregon, will be at Southern Oregon University's Britt Ballroom Sunday at the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books. And you can go to our website to get more information at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke and Sharifa Belkadus, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are engineers. Sharifa Belkadus also engineered today. Again, if you want to get our Daily Digest email sign-up list, you can go to our website at democracynow.org, get our headlines there. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!